I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Sir Tim Smith. Sir Tim is Executive Vice Chairman and co-founder of the award-winning Eden Project near St. Austell in Cornwall. Eden began as a dream in 1995 and opened its doors to the public in 2000. Since then, more than 18 million people have come to see what was once a sterile pit turned into a cradle of life, containing world-class horticulture and startling architecture symbolic of human endeavor. Eden has contributed over 1.7 billion pounds into the Cornish economy. Eden is proud of its success in changing people's perception of the potential for and the application of science by communicating and interpreting scientific concepts through the use of art, drama, and storytelling, as well as living up to its mission to take a pivotal role in local regeneration. It demonstrates once and for all that sustainability is not about sandals and nut cutlets, it's about good business practice and the citizenship values of the future. Sir Tim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. Please do call me Tim.
Will do. So Tim, what experiences have you had that have helped you understand what it takes to smash the plateau?
I think when you're treated like absolute rubbish in the music business, when you're a loser, it teaches you that when you have good fortune, never ever treat anybody like that again. And treating people well is the biggest secret to the luck changing. The big thing for me with the breaking a plateau is realizing that once too often you've spoken about the dreams you've got without bothering to pursue them. And I would say to anybody listening that feels as if they've come up against a brick wall, what I've learned is that most brick walls have got a brick-colored door in them, that if you dare to then take a risk, the risk will prove worthwhile because the world favors risk-takers who measure the risk according to their own passion. If your passion is about something you love and dearly want to do and it's something you really, really want to achieve, and it isn't simply about greed, power, or money, you'll be amazed how lucky you can get. That'd be the first thing. Losing your fear of being disliked and for the first time speaking your mind absolutely truthfully, even if it's uncomfortable, is another great secret to actually breaking the things that hem you in. Because it's extraordinary. It's a bit like getting your retaliation on the world in first. When you say it like it is, you suddenly free yourself to actually focus with no blinkers on your face and go forward.
And Tim, what is it about the music industry that is personal to you?
Well, it's full of creeps, and it's full of men over 50 who shouldn't be ogling young women, and it's full of people who are crooks. And the thing about the music industry is most people who go into it love music, and it can destroy you when you discover that it's just a way of making money after a while. So I decided, having had a lot of hit records, that I wanted to change my life. And the freakiest thing, that's how my plateau came about. I left the music industry. I went to Cornwall on a whim and didn't know what to do. And it is absolutely terrifying when you have no other skill or you think you haven't got another skill. And I was really worried that I might just have to take any old job. What was I fit for? And then I found this estate that had been lost for 70 years. And I cut my way in with the guy who owned it, and I fell in love. And I said, you know what? I'm going to just leap. I'm going to leap into the unknown. I know nothing about plants. I know nothing about gardens. I've never opened anything to the public in my life. But I know one thing, which is if you love something and you're not a freak, there will be millions and millions and millions of other people that will love it too. The only issue is marketing. Let people know. So I knew I was going to do that, and I got a gang of people around me, and we persuaded television to film us doing the restoration and transforming this place. And today it is the most visited and loved garden in Britain. And it was while I was there that we dreamt of the idea of doing the Eden Project in Cornwall. And I still know not that much about plants, but the one thing I have discovered is that everybody, without exception, has a desire for an adventure. So if you have a big dream, don't be frightened by the bigness of your dream. It's in fact small dreams that are difficult. Big dreams, if you can create a big stage, you create a home for lots of people who feel that they want to do something they can put on their tombstone. And strangely, they come to you and they want to be part of that great adventure. Great adventures is a whole secret of human life, I think. And there you go.
Tim, was this the first great adventure and the first big dream that you confronted?
Well, I fell into music by accident because I'd been playing music at college. So that was a career by accident. But discovering the Lost Gardens of Heligan was a complete moment. There's a movie called Fitzcarraldo about a man who wants to build an opera house in the middle of the Amazon, and it's a crazy film, and I identify completely with this guy Fitzcarraldo, because I realized that the moment you liberate yourself to believe that great things and great adventures can happen to people like you, you realize that the reason most of us don't have them is because we believe that they're not for little people like us. And I think one of the great things anybody who talks on your show can do is to say, look, I'm ordinary, like everybody else. I wasn't born with luck. I just believed that something could happen. And you know what? There is no reason why it can't happen in the middle of the most dull town, in the most dull country in the world, even to a dull person, if you just believe. And suddenly you can be infused with that good fortune. And if you like, the magnetism to make things happen. I really truly believe that, and I think the greatest gift you can give to other people is to make them believe in themselves and that there can be luck coming to them.
So how do you know when you are facing this big dream that it is really a big dream and that it is really your big adventure that's about to unfold?
There is an element of blind courage you need to have. But what I would say about risk-taking is this. Most people expend so much energy in anticipation of the risk, the anxiety at it, that if they just took the risk, all of that anxiety would go into the risk they'd just taken and would have halved the risk. And I think you have a sense whether you're onto the right thing. If you're a fool, you could embark on an adventure and you just get eaten by crocodiles because you just don't, you know, look at the obvious signs. I think what I mean about a great adventure is test it, you know, bite it like a coin to make sure it's proper coinage. Make sure that your adventure hasn't got a core flaw in it. Make sure, too, that lots of other people aren't embarking on the same adventure and therefore will make yours less special. But once you have a sense that it's good and that you soon get a feeling for it, because other people tend to say you're either completely mad or that you're a genius. People who say that something is okay, if your idea is only okay, don't do it. But if they call you mad and a genius in equal mix, you're probably on the right track.
That's actually brilliant.
I couldn't possibly comment.
No, seriously, because you know, I've had lots of people on the show talk about the naysayers when they're about to embark on something that turns out to be a plateau-smashing experience. And I'm not sure that I've had anybody on the show yet who's talked about having people comment on the both the genius of it and the, you know, not the same people obviously, but people saying that you're a genius and people saying that you're totally nuts in equal measure, and that's a test of the viability of the dream.
Yeah, and there are some other things one needs to do. I have about three or four rules, which, if I may share them with you.
Please.
One is kill negative people. Don't allow them anywhere near you. And if they do get near you, make their demise as painful and as bloody as possible, because they are alien spawn. They are the people who tell you when you have a good idea, what makes people like you think you're worthy of a good idea. Kill them, I say. Not really. If you're listening to this, this isn't a message from some god telling you to kill somebody. It's not literal, of course, but negative people are such a corrosive force. The other thing I said earlier is to learn to lose your fear of being disliked. Do the right thing. Don't worry about how other people think of you. Just do the right thing. The third thing is believe in last man standing. Believe that actually, if you have a certain amount of charm and people start to learn that you will not go away, they will eventually pay you to do so. It's been the secret of my success. The last thing I would share with you is something which is odd, and you may think this is freaky. Accept every third invitation you receive. It does not mean that you shouldn't accept the first, but every invitation you get, add them up and accept the third, and never ever turn it down unless it conflicts with a family commitment. There is a reason for this, because most people think they are open-minded and that they are educated and learning all the time, but in fact they're not. They're already pretty much in a state of stupor. It is only by putting yourself into organized jeopardy, by making yourself go to things that your natural spirit would tell you not to go to, that you understand the true magic of life. A fool tells you the secret is to meet the people you need to meet. Those are foolish, stupid, dull people. The real genius is when you meet the people you didn't know you were meant to meet. And you can only meet them by putting yourself in places where you would otherwise never have been, but by some kind of strange force of nature. Almost every single life-changing moment of my professional life has come by attending the third thing.
Well, it strikes me, Tim, that big adventure stories, whether it's books, movies, or whatever, they have a lot of this element of meeting the people that you didn't know you were supposed to meet.
Exactly. And that's absolutely right. And I'll give you an example. In 1997, I picked up an invitation to go and speak to 50 people and a dog in a shed about 180 miles from our office. My PA said, "You can't do that. You're supposed to go to London the following morning. You'll be exhausted." I said, "I have to go. It is the third invitation." I went, and there were 50 people and a dog. And it was a very enjoyable evening. They were very nice, those 50 people, but it was not a large audience. 3 months later, I went to a very large public meeting at which the decision was going to be made as to whether the Eden Project would get a very significant sum of money from the government. There was an argument amongst all of the politicians who were there. We were not going to get our money. The Eden Project would not have gone ahead but for that money. So we were looking at failure just there and then. And an old man got up in the audience and he said to all the assembled company, he said, "I know this man. And 3 months ago, he came to speak to us in a shed in the middle of nowhere. So I know that he has the concerns of the wider environment in his interest, rather than the narrow confines of where he lives. We in Somerset, which is another county next to Cornwall, will forego one of our projects so the Eden Project can go ahead, if you will all forego one other one." And he then sat down, and we got £12.7 million voted to us, because one man who attended me speaking in a shed in the middle of nowhere was convinced by the fact that I had been there and my third invitation that I was a different person and that I needed support, and it came. Life is like that.
It sure is.
Seize those moments, yeah.
It sure is. So I wonder, can you walk us through a little bit about what you experienced in creating the Eden Project and how it fits these four principles that you've just mentioned?
It is quite obviously insane to be in a place where only 500,000 people live and you are 280 miles from the capital city of London to think about building something that you will bill as the eighth wonder of the world. It will be the biggest building in Europe. In fact, it has the second biggest span of any building in the world after Cape Canaveral in your dear country. And we wanted to make it and build it in a mine. And I wanted to build it in a mine because this was a place that was as derelict can be, and there was no life in it. And the idea that we could create life in this place and then show the genius of humans by building a wonderful building in there to show off that life, I think was symbolically the most powerful thing we could do. It is about the possibility of Homo sapiens genuinely being sapient, wise. And I'm passionate about the fact that it is those soft moments of iconic, if you like, symbolism that will transform our era, our period. We're living in very, very exciting times. I can't tell you how exciting it is to be alive now, and yet we have a media that only want to tell us about how the world is going to hell in a handcart. But if I was to tell you, there have been more inventions, scientific inventions, in the last 17 years than in the whole history of humankind up until now, and that we're living through a period which makes the Renaissance seem like child's play and the Age of Enlightenment look like a household party, I would not be lying. We're living at a point in history where we're on the dawning of discovering that the microbes that inhabit us and the microbes that make up the soil and the fungi and the things that are the force of life are all one and the same thing. We are at the brink of discovering that humans are earthlings like everything else. That is unbelievably exciting. I mean, unbelievably exciting. So the journey for me has been one of understanding how to be, if you like, a chimera, an actor in the music industry, feeling tremendously like an imposter, and then just deciding one day, my plateau corresponded to the moment of deciding to ask myself, what happens if you try to be as good as you can be? By which I mean, you try your best, which means that you sleep really, really well because you're tired out. You may have done a bad job, but it was still the best you could do. So you're never looking over your shoulders worrying whether anybody's going to discover you're an imposter because you're too tired even bothering to be one. And again, that's incredibly liberating. And Heligan, I'm quite sure, the Lost Gardens of Heligan came out of this desire to just not allow anybody to say no. I had no money, but people came and the cameras came. And then the cameras came and they made a mistake when they broadcast the program. They forgot to say that we weren't open, so the visitors came. So we had to rip a toilet out of a portable toilet, and a man stood there with some cloakroom tickets that we'd got from Woolworths and started to sell tickets to come in. And 40,000 people came in that first year before we were even meant to be open. And so we made some money so we could employ some people, and then we had to employ even more people. As the next year, 80,000 people came, and today 350,000 people a year come to see this pretty small garden. And it has a life all of its own. More than 400 people have been cremated and had their ashes scattered there. More people than I can count have proposed to people there. And Heligan, an awful lot of people have learnt, is an anagram of the word healing. So thousands of people a year come there in the hope that it will do something for them. And many write to me and say that it does. But actually, what we've done is we've restored a garden which is not special in any way whatsoever, except one, which is that everything you've ever loved in any garden of the world seems to be there, but in small scale. And so nobody who goes there feels small. They feel as if they could own it. It feels like their place. And that makes it the most romantic place in the world. And I think the journey to Eden came out of believing that actually the world isn't about money. It's about thousands of acts of friendship, emotional strength, and loving stuff, because actually the greatest magnetic force, which will make you money, but the greatest magnetic force is in loving something so much you want to tell people about it with enthusiasm, and that when they come, they can see why, because it speaks to bit in them. And that's what I would say to anybody listening to this show, is actually the greatest feeling in the whole damn world is doing something you love, so that you can turn to anybody and you can talk with pride about the adventure you've had. And the fact that you did that adventure with so many people, because no one wants to talk to a sad sack who is the genius, whose sole idea it was, whose moment of epiphany has changed the world because they are such a shining light. These are boring people. Who wants to work with people like that? Nah, the best line I ever heard is from the guy who's the boss of Rolls Royce, who said, always start meetings with how can we improve this, which means that anybody who's leading is not claiming they have the answer. And I'll leave you with that. I think it's a great, great time to be alive. Therefore, kill negative people, believe in yourself, chase your adventures, and fall in love lots.
So, Tim, with that in mind, I wonder if we can go back to something you said earlier, which is about the notion of risk-taking, and that there's a lot of anxiety that one may feel before starting to take action. How do you overcome that anxiety and take that first step?
First step is a good example. Have you, when you were younger, did you never climb up one of those diving boards in a public park to go into a swimming pool, and you get to the top and you realize it's a lot higher than you thought, and you're now thinking, oh heck, do I climb back down because this is going to hurt if I do a belly flop, or even worse, I go in and the elastic on my swimming trunks isn't tight enough and I'll end up in the middle of the swimming pool naked? Or do you think, crikey, they're going to think I'm a coward? And what happens is, look, the secret of doing things and getting over risk is to put yourself in the company of the people you most respect in the whole world and tell them you're going to do this thing. I'll tell you why you do that. Because the fear of being thought a loser because you didn't dare becomes the fuel that makes you actually take the risk.
That's very powerful. Very powerful.
Well, it works for me, and it works for lots of people I've told about it, because actually, why do people jump out of aircraft when they're doing charity parachute jumps? Because they're slightly more scared of being thought of being a coward than they are of dying.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Tim, how do core values play into the decisions that we make around risk-taking and pursuing our dreams?
Core values, a bit like authenticity and words like that, I'm a little suspicious of. Let us go and be standing in a bar having one drink too many for the 100th time in our life, and you hear your voice saying what you're going to do, the adventure you're going to have, the book you're going to write, the company you're going to set up. And then go fast forward to the following morning, and that little bit of self-loathing that builds up and accretes to the previous bits of self-loathing as you realize you're not the person you dreamt you could be. And actually, the thing about core values is about believing that you can be the person you dreamt you could be and grabbing it by the throat. And the weirdest thing is, it's a bit like when you're a smoker and you quit smoking, like I did, or you're a heavy drinker and you decide to temper it. You fear it because it's kind of an addiction. Being a loser, as in your own terms, is often simply, well, what if I don't take any risks, I won't fail. And suddenly, once you've redescribed your life as being a really precious thing to you, and that you want your life to mean something, by which I mean that you'd like to think that on your tombstone someone else might write, the world was a better place for you having existed. It's really funny. It gets easier and easier. And you stop adding up your life in terms of like an accountancy thing with an abacus working out how many good things have I done or how many bad things have I done, how much money have I made. It's actually how many times has the rhythm of my life felt good? How many times have I gone to bed at night feeling really blissfully tired because I've worked myself to a gentle, proper tiredness? And how many times have I done the right thing and I know it was the right thing? There's sometimes a tremendous thrill in doing the right thing because you know it's the right thing, but also knowing how easy the temptation was and no one would have known to have done the wrong thing and you would have prospered from it. What I can tell you, having had such temptations put in front of me, that the reward inside you for the moment of foregoing such temptation far outweighs any of the benefits you would have had you fallen for it. And I wish most people knew that, because I think that would make them feel very differently about some of the temptations we all fall for.
Yeah, that's for sure. Tim, whom do you know personally who has been really successful at smashing plateaus?
Who do I know personally that's been? Well, I mean, there are, I know personally, I lay no claim to their friendship, but I know them. If you were to look at very famous people, look at Richard Branson, who smashed his plateau of suffering with terrible dyslexia and getting around that and actually realizing he had gifts that compensated for it, that gave him a bravery to do everything he has done since. Now, that was young. William Golding, the writer, who I don't know, who at the age of 57 wrote his first book. Who else can I think of? James Dyson, who everybody told was an idiot. And he just kept going. He kept going. He kept going. How long was he told he was an idiot? And then suddenly he was a genius. Look at J.K. Rowling, rejected by everybody. What an idiot fairy story that is. No one will publish that. Just got to keep going. Keep the faith. Keep believing. More importantly, though, about a real plateau, I want to talk about my partner at the Lost Gardens of Heligan, a guy called John Nelson, who was a builder. And he was full of stories about what life could have dished up for him. He built some marvelous houses, and lots of people had become very rich because of him, but he still had, you know, a weekly wage. And when I discovered the Lost Gardens, what were to become the Lost Gardens of Heligan, he said, can I join you? And it's the best thing that ever happened to me, I tell you. But it was as if a life had led up to that moment. He was already gone 50, and he had all the skills I didn't. We used to make a joke. I would talk about it, and he'd do the work. And he rebuilt all the glass houses, rebuilt the buildings that had been brought down by trees growing through them. He cobbled miles and miles of drains and courtyards, you know, created the gardens, restored things. He was just brilliant. He worked. When people say they work 20-hour days, they're usually exaggerating to make a point. This man, every daylight hour and a lot of nighttime hours working with hurricane lamps, this guy worked and worked and worked. Because for him, this was the moment of liberating a life of experience into one dream that could make him feel that people could see who he was. And he was the star of that show. And it makes me cry still thinking about it. He died 2 years ago, January, 2 years ago. And I would not be the man I am today. I would never have been and discovered finished Heligan, or would I have thought of doing Eden if it hadn't been for a humble guy who was a builder, a tradesman, who dared to say, I'm going to gamble everything. This is a guy who, you know, needed a weekly wage, and he just closed his eyes and jumped. And that is a mark of bravery that is unbelievable. But actually, it's also incredibly important. And I keep saying this to people. We live in a world where everybody tells you university is important. The world was made by people who went to university. And that is because universities have stolen the clothes of the blue collar people who actually made the Industrial Revolution, who built half of these magnificent buildings we call, you know, the symbols of civilization. And I think that when it comes down to the final reckoning, it's people like John Nelson, the people who actually learnt by looking, by feeling, by touching, that actually shaped our civilization and let the rest of us actually ride on their coattails and then forget them. And I think it's really important that we don't forget, that we never forget that our good fortune is built on the talents of others. And so John Nelson would be my greatest moment of a person, greatest example of a man with a reaching a plateau who decided to leap. And boy, the repercussions of his big lump jump were amazing.
Wow. Tim, what can we look forward to from you in the near future?
Well, you know what Woody Allen always used to say, that God's idea of humor was watching humans making plans. But if we allow for maybe some kindness from whoever my God is, that I don't get struck by lightning or something, I'm hoping that we're going to build a wonderful project in the Sierra Nevada mountains in your own beautiful country. That's imminent. We are going to be building an Eden project dedicated to Antarctica and the Southern Oceans in Hobart in Tasmania. And we are already contracted to build a brilliant Eden project, which is four times bigger than the one we have at the moment, in the city of Tsingtao in China, about 150 miles to the east of Beijing on the coast there, the old German colony. And that's going to be dedicated to water. So those are the marvelous things that are in the pipeline at the moment. We're also working on a lovely project in the great city of Derry in Northern Ireland, where we're doing a project linking a whole bunch of estates that are along the River Foyle. Some of them are Catholic and some of them are Protestant. And of course, you'll be aware in America of Derry was, if you like, the sparking point for what is now euphemistically called the Troubles. And these projects, which bring people from both sides of the so-called divide together, to mend that sectarian rift, are very important. And it's really moving, working on projects like this. That this isn't hundreds of millions of project. This is probably single figure millions, but the importance of it could be more than any of the others. So I'm just really excited. I feel the coming years have got lots and lots of marvelous things to offer. And I look forward to everybody listening to this show, daring to take some risks and to change the world into a place that makes lots of people smile.
So, Tim, how can listeners learn more about you, your work, and follow what we've just talked about?
There's the website, which you find it at www.theedenproject.com. There is a book that I wrote called The Eden Project, which is utterly brilliant. It is devastatingly good and rather dull. I say that actually not to be self-deprecating. I've written four books, two big sellers. One is The Lost Gardens of Heligan, which is about the eponymous Lost Gardens, and the other one is called Eden. But Eden, I wrote deliberately as almost a manual for having adventures. I didn't write it in a romantic way. I wrote it in an incredibly factual way, leaving all the detail in, so anybody wanting to follow my footsteps or wanting to have an adventure could read the book and understand all the steps you need to take to have an adventure. Because the trouble is, most people write their history backwards and make it seem very glamorous, and they forget all the steps that led to the moments that were successful. And actually, to be successful, there are usually quite a lot of blind alleys you need to go up. And if you want to have an adventure, do read that book, because it will show you some of the blind alleys we went up and maybe give you some of the shortcuts that you can learn from our mistakes. And believe me, everybody makes mistakes. The secret is to be able to make mistakes, but actually then describe them as a huge success.
That's so true. And learning from others what shortcuts you can take can be very helpful. So thank you for sharing that. Tim, it's been really wonderful having you on the show today on Smashing the Plateau. Your experiences and what you've described, I think, is really can be very helpful for our listeners about how to overcome obstacles in life and in business, and in particular, how to have the courage and understand the circumstances around you to take action and move forward. And you're right, it's really all about taking that first step and how powerful that can be.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Sir Tim Smith, the Executive Vice Chair and co-founder of the Eden Project. Thank you again, Tim, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by Tend Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Have you ever hit a plateau in your own life or career? If so, let's talk. It would be my pleasure to take you through one of our free half-hour discovery sessions, where we'll get to the bottom of what might be keeping you stuck and how to move things forward. Just give me a call at 212-731-0770. That's 212-731-0770. You never know what you might find out.